It is Saturday, November 8th, 2008, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, Tequila Diamonds.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Sean Cleveland, Senior Technical Marketing Manager at NVIDIA. Morning, Sean.
Good morning, Lyle.
Miles Elam. Miles is a student, programmer, and political junkie, and Miles, congratulations on getting into UCSC. That means you'll be hovering in my neck of the woods for the next 7 years.
Always a pleasure being here.
7 years.
No, it's been eight.
Well, yeah, Cabrillo, but it's going to be another seven at UCSC. And Ben Jaffe, the only person here with a bachelor's degree, freelance media guy. Hi.
Aw, shucks.
You're the most educated person here, Ben.
I suppose so.
But it doesn't show.
Certainly not at all.
He has the most proof of the education.
Yeah, he's not the most educated.
Yeah, I would disagree with you.
A lot longer than he has.
You've been in school a lot longer than the Earth's been spinning, Miles.
Eternally. And forever till the end of time.
So today we're going to be doing a lot of geek news. And right in the beginning, before the show started, I said tequila diamonds. Miles, please explain, because Sean looked at me like I was insane.
One area of semiconductors these days is diamonds.
Oh.
Trying to move in that direction because diamonds are harder than
girl's
silicon.
Sorry.
They are far more resistant to heat and to any type of damage. Like someone scratching a surface, you know, you have a diamond, it's going to be a lot safer than
sure.
If you have
so
a
wait a minute,
material.
You'd have a processor and a diamond. Actually, we covered this many years ago.
Yeah, the idea of it.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And Neil Stephenson, the author, also talks
Neil
about...
Neil Stevenson.
In Diamond Age.
We had an argument
about
Age, this.
Yeah,
is it Stevenson
about,
or Stephenson?
Well, what do you think it is, Stephenson?
Well, you know, every person who spells their name P-H, Stephen, that I know, is pronounced Stephen.
Okay.
Except Stevenson. Alex's brother is Stephen, but anyway.
In
any case, Neil Stevenson, or Neil Stephenson,
you know what?
Who wrote Diamond Age, talks about how amazing
Neil,
diamonds are.
Neil, you need
are.
To come on to our show, and then you can settle this once and for all.
Yeah, definitely. Neil, you need to come on this show.
We'll sell it.
But diamond has aspects like silicon where it's normally an electrical insulator, but it can become a semiconductor if it's doped with the right materials.
Right, which is actually how silicon works. The silicon itself is actually an insulator, but you can add materials and then make devices that are...
Right.
What am I looking for? The word.
But currently,
transistors.
Yeah, currently, to make any type of a diamond film over your surface is prohibitively expensive. It's really hard to get the right mixture. And so it was nice when University of Nuevo León near Monterrey in Mexico used tequila. It just happened to have the right
amount of carbon.
Nitrogen,
so they took
oxygen.
I'm assuming they compressed it.
They put it into a... sorry, I'm like flipping through here.
Miles is using his iPhone to look at news.
I have to say,
they
I
injected
think
the heated vapor from 80 proof tequila, tequila blanco, so white tequila, into a low pressure chamber. And then basically using that, the carbon deposited on the test surfaces carbon deposition had a diamond structure.
But one of the things about making silicon wafers stuff is that you actually have to make a really pure agate of silicon that is one crystal, basically. Can they do that?
Well, they could always get a pure thing of carbon. The issue was...
No, what I'm saying, for silicon, you have to grow the agate itself, the entire thing that you slice a layer off. That's one big crystal. That's why it's got a really clean structure. So can you do that with the sublimation? Can you make one crystal, or is it multiple crystals that bump into each other?
Well, not sublimation, deposition.
Excuse me.
Apparently, they've gotten a lot closer to it.
That's pretty cool. And they use tequila. Did they use tequila because why not? I remember when we talked about the first diamonds being made by people, it was peanut butter. Well, they jammed peanut butter in a big piston and just smashed the heck out of it and made diamonds.
Well, there's all sorts of things happen through random purposes. Like AZT, the original AIDS drug, was actually a compound found in seagull semen.
Mm-hmm.
And what? Who would think to use that? But you,
well, who would think not to?
Right. It's just you try different things. You have the
so you're saying that they were actually just trying different materials to get the right kind of consistency, and tequila happened to work.
Well, they're in Mexico, so yeah, I'm sure they probably went like, yeah, I wonder what happens if I do this.
It's such a great thing. It's like, oh man, I'm giving up too. Yeah, and they're drinking one night. Hey, you guys, we got to try it.
Yeah, it's like, hey, why not? Let's try this out. See what happens. Right. Yeah, what's the worst that could happen? It doesn't work like all the other experiments. All
right.
Hey.
That's cool. Thanks, Miles, for that update.
I just have to say that I think it's remarkable that you can do geek news on the iPhone. I need 15 inches of my screen and cut and paste. I can't do geek news on an iPhone.
Give it 8 years. You don't necessarily get better, but you get more efficient.
I had a little bit of a hiccup there, so you know it wasn't all perfect. I'm getting better at this.
That's amazing.
Any case, let's go on.
We need to get back to this Neil Stephenson thing.
Okay, yes, yeah. Neil Stephenson.
There's a whole webpage. But, you know, I actually met Neil Stephenson at Cody's Books in Berkeley.
Oh, so you're the expert.
And he talked, and he was introduced as Neil Stephenson. I remember that.
Okay.
But there's a website that talks about how somebody knew his mother and
Stephenson.
Stephenson.
All right. So in any case, let's go on from diamonds and tequila. Thank you very much, Miles. And Sean, thanks for clarifying. Do you think we could get Neil on the show?
Stephenson? Yeah.
I'd love to.
And people who don't know who he is, he wrote the famous and amazing book, Snow Crash.
And then also Diamond Age, which we were just referencing, yeah, which I like is a very good
Cryptonomicon, which I thought was also an amazing
book, especially if you're a math geek.
And he's got a new book out called Anathem.
Oh, okay. So he's touring. All right. Well, we'll work on that. Let's go ahead and go on to a story that I saw. Somebody sent an email to me about it this week, which was that Apple, it looks like AT&T recently decided that they're going to allow the iPhone to tether to laptops. So basically, at the Web 2.0 summit, the AT&T Mobility president and CEO Ralph De La Vega told an interviewer that the company is working with Apple to let the iPhone serve as a modem, basically. So you tether it via Bluetooth, and then that iPhone's connection is also
a wireless tether.
A wireless tether. So it's one of these features that I think a lot of people really wanted on the iPhone. It's the reason why they didn't go with it. It makes sense to do it, but it's a real drain on the network.
People really do this.
People really do this. They'll go and use their mobile device to use their internet connection. Yeah, definitely. Especially when you've got 3G support, a little faster. In any case, I just thought it was kind of interesting.
I guess maybe.
Let's move on. Miles, well, actually, you already went with Mark.
All I did is talk about Neil Stephenson's name. Can I do a news story?
Yeah, after Ben. So, Ben. No. Sean, please. What you got, man?
Wow. I got a bunch of news. Let's talk about this using your wireless for connectivity,
okay,
or you know, using your cell phone for tethering. Well, the FCC unanimously approved the use of the white space for
that's
Wi-Fi.
Right. That's right.
So what is white space?
Well, you have black space, and it's the opposite. It's like the absence of color and darkness. So it's white.
I think he means, what does the FCC mean by white space?
So DTV, digital television, there's a lot of little holes there that are used by wireless microphones and other devices that not a lot of people use. And the Wi-Fi market has been wanting to get access to this because the frequency range of white space, which is anywhere between 54 megahertz and 698 megahertz.
We're talking about between channels, between...
yeah, exactly. It's between channels.
Okay.
So this frequency space goes long distances, kilometers, and they go through walls.
And so it would be perfect for wireless solutions.
I mean, we'd finally have a city wireless solution, a mesh network, that would work.
So, because it would require... Well, the technology would be available for it. There's still the political will.
I'm just saying, from purely technical standpoint, the fact that you can go longer distances and go through buildings would require less hardware and would make that more feasible.
Okay, I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
Is the white space use is this for television space, like the traditional television space?
For digital television.
Why hasn't it been available for a long time?
I think because you've got the people who are actually using that space now have been really good at lobbying. You know, they didn't want this space opened up.
Oh, no, no.
Especially...
I remember this. What this is as we switch from the analog to the digital, there's space that opens up. When we start turning off the analog, it's not as efficient, and that's where this white space is. It's the space that's...
I don't think that's it, because it's space that was previously used by wireless microphones, as an example, and certainly holes are opening up. But
listen to this. This is the article. White space, the 700 megahertz spectrum that's being freed up as TV channels switch from fat analog signals to thinner digital transmissions has the potential to be used for many important purposes. So it has to do with the switch,
right? And
frequency being
devices wishing to use these vacant channels, that are part of this frequency. They have to have the ability to scan the spectrum for available frequencies, and then the ability to geolocate themselves, itself, and cross-link its location in an internet database to make sure there's no overlap.
So there's
some sophistication behind these devices.
Because they can't collide.
They can't collide. Uh-huh. And the problem, the biggest problem that people are foreseeing is like at stadiums where wireless microphones are used, and currently... devices that use these areas would interfere with wireless outside of the stadium.
Right.
So, but kind of interesting. I'm excited about it.
Great. Thank you very much for the update on that. Mm-hmm. Let's go on now to Ban. We'll give you a turn. Go ahead, sir.
Okay. Hold on. I'm messing with my Windows here. Okay.
So you have no excuse because you have a laptop.
I know. I have 15-inch. I don't know how he does it.
You should be on top.
But anyway, so the Northern Lights were filmed in three dimensions for the first time. And this isn't really 3D, but it's kind of faux 3D. It gives the appearance of 3D. So you can put on these glasses and look at what the Northern Lights look like in kind of a three-dimensional way, where they appear to have depth.
The glasses, are they polarized lenses, or are they the red-blue?
No, they're not the red-blue. Okay. They're the polarized ones. And so
the general idea is that whenever you look at the Northern Lights, it's this really beautiful pattern of color, and it's very translucent, and it's, of course, in a very dark environment and cold.
But it's 10 miles away, so you can't see depth.
And you have no idea about what light is in front of which, because they're all kind of translucent. Yeah. So this is done from a few different really wide angles,
You have two cameras, for example, 10 miles away. So the way depth perception works is you've got two eyes, and these eyes see images from different angles, and then your brain can kind of extrapolate how far the object is away. But once you get pretty far away, like several hundred feet or miles, then you can't rely on your eyes because they're too close together relative to the distance of between you and the object. And so,
is the footage available?
It is. It's pretty cool.
Do they do a 3D version online?
I don't know. I don't think so. With 3D, you can the only distribution method that I know of online is with the red blue glasses.
And that would destroy the effect anyway because it's color.
Exactly. So you'd see a nice monochrome. Kind of weird.
Maybe someone at like a display company that is previewing new types of technology could take this footage and put it into a new screen or something.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. What they do now is they have these lenses that are polarized opposite ways, 90 degrees to each other.
That's an older technology too. The newest thing is actually switching, like real switching.
Oh yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So
that requires a special monitor and a syncing device between the glasses.
Both require special monitors or special projectors, or all of them require glasses. And then there are technologies also where you have a monitor that is sending out different images to different to actually different angles. So if you're sitting still in the correct place in any one of these hotspots, you can actually see 3D without glasses, which is very, very cool. But in any case, so the way they captured this is they took two video cameras, and they placed them 10 miles apart. So effectively kind of the same effect that we get with the eyeballs being, however many inches apart. But in this case, because the Northern Lights are so far apart, you put the cameras further apart. And so the effect is you get kind of a smaller version of the Northern Lights hovering in front of you, which apparently is pretty cool. And they did this DV. It wasn't HDV because they started about 5 years ago, and that wasn't standard technology. And also, one of the reasons it took so long is because of all the preparation needed to go film in such cold weather. Like -40, like 40 below. And keeping the technology operating also efficiently. So yeah.
Very cool. Well, thanks for...
how much money that cost.
Oh, and it's also time-lapse, I should say, because the Northern Lights are very slow changing. So.
Nice. Oh, cool. Well, I'd love to see the footage in 3D,
It's really neat. It's like 8 hours of footage all compressed down into a...
Cool. All right, thanks for that. Speaking of 3D, let's go ahead and talk about Wolf Blitzer and Anderson Cooper lying to us on television. Mm. If you saw CNN...
No, let's not blame them. I mean, they were part of the conspiracy.
The conspiracy.
Wow.
The conspiracy to fool their viewers.
Okay, what we're talking about is election. CNN. What we're talking about is election night coverage on CNN had, quote, holograms, people, and also some 3D imagery that was kind of fans of representation of Congress and Senate. And anyway, the 3D, the hologram thing was basically a person that was not actually in the studio showing up in the studio with a blue haze around them. And Wolf Blitzer and Anderson Cooper both interacted with them like they could see them. And everybody's calling this really neat, and how are they doing it? And really, it's not as neat as you think. That person was not in the studio. They were inserted after the fact in the video footage. Wolf and to a lesser extent, Anderson Cooper were just acting and... could show and pretended that they could see them.
Yep.
And I say to a lesser extent because, of course, Ben, you mentioned that Anderson Cooper actually at one point was going, in a second we'll have our hologram in here and the person is theoretically standing in front of them.
Yeah, supposedly standing. So, yeah, they're just talking to just thin air. Yeah, right. And what frustrated me wasn't that they did it. I mean, it seemed kitschy. It seemed really kind of sensationalist and ridiculous. Kind of neat, though, from a technology perspective or technological perspective. But they were pretending that they could see her in the studios or him, which they very clearly could not.
And they were using the term hologram. And a hologram is very specifically an image that appears in space. And that's not what was happening.
That was compositing. That was digital video compositing.
It was very well done.
It was extremely well done. In fact, it was all the geeks went, wow, this is tracking with a camera moving. How are they doing that?
Exactly.
That's impressive. And we're all like, that's a lot of processing power. How are they capturing imagery? And one of the things they did say is that the target person that was, quote, injected in, whatever, they were in a room with a whole bunch of HD cameras. So we were talking about that. And Ben, you found a great little video, a 3D model of that space.
There's a website that has a QuickTime VR of it, but we're not going to post the link because it's a suspected phishing site.
That's great.
So both Google and Firefox warned me when I tried to go to that.
And if we link to it, we have higher probability of being a phishing site, so we won't link to it. But basically, one of the things they did is make a circle of cameras around the person.
Yeah.
And then they were able to use
like a two-thirds circle.
Each of those cameras. And there's like I guess in that picture you see about 15 computers, a tower, probably Windows machines sitting on the desk.
Yeah.
And they're interpreting the different angles between the cameras to be able to pan around them.
Yeah, it's called frame interpolation. It's when you have, like the simplest method of frame interpolation is you have two cameras and you try to get an image that, you try to get the image that you would get if you put a camera between those two cameras without actually having a third camera. And you take those two frames and you kind of analyze and try to figure out which pixels are where in the different images. And then you can kind of get a faux 3D idea or the computer can, and then
it
can make it.
Yeah, it's very equivalent to if you're a Flash programmer of using tweens.
Yes,
it's that idea of a tween, and it's an animation concept where if a person draws a character in one state and another state and wants a frame in between, you can theoretically say, well, this would be close enough, especially since you're only seeing a second of it.
Yeah, it's kind of a morph.
The thing that was interesting, the idea of actually injecting the person in, I tried to explain this. I was interviewed yesterday by a student at UCSC who's also, I think the story will be in the Sentinel, but Santa Cruz Sentinel. But one of the things was very hard to explain that it's not 3D in any way, really. It's just injecting it's, in. And the example that I used was in professional sports, like in football, when you see the goal line or the yard line? The yard line being marked, so when they're trying to get a first down there's a line that's yellow, and it gets put on the grass. Of course, that's not really there. They've got a whole bunch of programs to inject it into the video feed, and it's not really 3D. It's that all the cameras have sensors on them and know their pitch and angle. And
they know where they are as well.
And they know where they are. And with that information and knowing where the grass is, you can say, draw a line at this exact space on the screen. And, of course, in that situation, they're using the grass as a green screen, which is kind of clever.
It is, yeah. It's gotten really good, too.
Really
when it first came out, it was really bad. There were lines all over people.
You can't even tell that it's not real.
Yeah, I mean, you really have to look for the glitches now. You know, if you look at it, I don't know, came out maybe 5 years. I'm not sure how long ago, but if you looked at it, you know, in the first year after it came out, it just wasn't very good. But then, you know, they really, really improved on the intelligent.
Right.
It's at some point it becomes not as much chroma keying as it is just kind of, you know, I guess it's chroma keying. But, you know, if you have dirt blotch on
it's
the...
It's image-based chroma keying. But, Miles?
It's intelligent chroma keying.
I'm sorry, I can't help. This is geek speak, but it's still nice to point out that you would be lynched in many parts of the country if you didn't know that it's the first down line in a line of scrimmage.
I knew that. I just didn't say it because Lyle
You know what? I'm a geek. I don't know about sports. There you go, everybody.
I think my mom would be upset
one thing
if
I don't know about
notice.
Sports. I knew it was I knew what the purpose was.
Yeah. No, I had the same thing happen to me when I went flying out the rest of the country and was doing a training session. People were talking about fantasy football, and I made a major faux pas by saying, "What's that?"
Oh, no.
Oh.
And then never lived down. Okay, so
here's
the thing.
Chill in the room.
Next time you're talking to someone who has political difference with you and you're discussing politics and you're talking about the elections and stuff and you want to change the subject, bring up the hologram and say, did you know the hologram wasn't really a hologram? Mm-hmm. And then you'll get off the politic discussion. You'll start talking about technology that everybody loves and everything will be good. So there you go.
Yeah, I really was
hologram.
Hoping that Anderson Cooper would just be like, you know what? I can't see this, darn it. You know, this is crummy.
It seems like Anderson Cooper would just be so critical, you know.
Or just say it completely deadpan. I can't see that.
This is dumb.
This is dumb.
I was actually thinking if he says, I can't see this, that his bosses would be saying, well, I can't see your paycheck either.
The thing is, they could have said that it wouldn't. Like, this, the other thing is, we're used to, I'm assuming that almost everyone knows that when a weatherman is sitting in front of a screen or a weather person is sitting in front of the screen, what are they called? What's the person that handles weather?
No, a weatherman?
No.
Weather person?
No, there's a scientific
weather
name for a person
woman?
That studies
meteorologist.
Weather. Thank you. When the meteorologist is standing in front of the screen and there's a map there with, you know, clouds coming in, they're just pointing to a green wall.
Actually,
everybody
not,
knows that,
not
right?
All
wait, not anymore.
Weather people what? Are actual have a degree in meteorology. So.
A person on the television showing what's happening.
Playing the role of the meteorologist.
They don't see what's on the screen?
They do not see what's behind them,
oh,
except for
God.
By seeing in front of them a video monitor.
Right, it's true. Right.
It's true.
And all this time,
the question is, like, when I saw this whole, you know, the whole hologram thing, I'm like, oh, that's cool. I know how they do it and everything. And then 2 days later, someone's like, ah, that hologram technology. I went, what? No, that's not hologram. Like, it didn't even enter my mind that people would think that it's real. But
I mean,
of course people would.
There are a few
Why
ways to do a real hologram, but several of them involve spinning mirrors. So if they had this humongous 6-foot-tall spinning tilted mirror and some
real,
intense projector, that would be a real hologram. But, you know, she wouldn't materialize out of thin air. Anderson Cooper or whoever would be looking at the spinning mirror and then suddenly, you know, she'd appear
in this.
Yeah,
so they use the wrong word. No big deal. I mean, come on. Like, evolution is just a theory.
What? How did that come in, Miles?
It's frustrating and misleading. I'm sure geeks everywhere.
Who cares about the word you use?
It's not a hologram. All right. But they made diamonds out of tequila.
Also, Yellen claimed that she, Jessica Yellen, claimed she was the first person to be beamed in a quote, hologram on live TV. Obviously, it wasn't a hologram, but also there were holographic type effects that were used back in the Live Earth concert, and Al Gore popped up on stage and gave a spiel and everything. And it looked pretty cool as well. And I had heard that.
Star Wars has been on.
Well, live TV.
Well, Star Wars has been on TV before.
That's right, when R2-D2, you know,
yeah, that's
beams that, the projection of totally. Princess Leia inches tall.
So. But I don't know. I mean, holographic technology exists, but that just wasn't it, period.
Yeah, and it doesn't exist at the level of being able to do what they did. You could not do that with a hologram.
You could dream about doing that.
I have dreamed about doing that. I'd like to sit in the studio empty and have you guys at your home so not the smell.
Oh, that's
like
perfect.
The newscasters had to be actors. That's so funny.
Wait, why would we need to be holograms
next time,
here?
Next time,
we're on the radio live.
Next time we have a phone call come in and we put on air and stuff, we should say we're beaming them through holographic technology. Radio hologram. Geek Speak on KOSB is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. Hey, everybody, I got a giveaway thing I want to tell you about. a friend of ours got together with us and got some great headphones from Plantronics. It's the Audio 350s, and actually we were using them the other night, and they're pretty cool. In any case, we've got 10 of them to give away to GeekSpeak listeners. So what we're going to do is I'm actually invite you to a summit thing. It's called the Public Media Camp, and you might have heard about this on KOSP. Basically, Quiddities, a Santa Cruz web development firm, Radio Engage, and KOSP are kind of promoting this thing with Next Space, which is a weekend bar camp. A bar camp is a conference where the participants actually plan the event. So next week, on November 14th is opening night, and November 15th and 16th, this is a whole conference about public media. It's the future of public media. The main question is, what is the future of public media? And some of the ideas, and basically everybody that shows up that's interested in public media, we're talking about radio, we're talking about TV, we're talking about anything that's in some way public, but also, of course, about the internet space, which I'm sure will be a big part of this. I'm looking forward to it. In any case, you're welcome to come. It's free. And if you have some knowledge about this, you can talk about what your knowledge is, and then everybody sets up the whole schedule, and you might be put on to speak about something. So it's kind of a cool participatory culture thing. But there's an opening night celebration on November 14th. That's Friday. And what we're going to do is we're going to have 10 Plantronics headsets by GeekSpeak and Plantronics, and we're going to hand them out in some pseudo-random fashion. So if you'd like to learn more information...
Wait, what? Say that again?
Some pseudo-random fashion.
No, what do we got?
Plantronics headsets.
We do. Plantronics actually gave us a bunch of headsets to give out to you guys for free.
I just said this.
I just think it's really cool.
It is very cool.
I mean, and they sent us a box of headsets.
Yeah.
How cool is that?
It's awesome. I mean, first of all, I'd like to give things to the people that like listening.
And you tried a pair, right?
Oh, yeah. They're really good. In fact, this almost exact same model as the one we're giving out, I bought 6 months ago, and I use them regularly. So yeah. I like them actually quite a bit. The ones that we're giving out are... they're using TRS connectors for a mic and headphones. So they're headphones and a microphone. So they're perfect for something like Skype. In fact, I don't know. I'm kind of thinking we'll start doing call-in questions, take questions via Skype. And so
That'd be really
especially neat. If someone gets one of these, they can contact me and then we'll get them on air through it. We've done
that
this.
That would be cool.
We've done this. We've had Alex on via Skype. I think I'm not sure if he uses a pair like this, but
we could beam them in via Skype.
We could beam
and
them
we
in.
And we can have, you know, Skype this video. So
if you want to learn, more about the bar camp, public media camp that's happening next weekend, go to kosp.org and you'll learn more about that there. So there's that information. Oh, imagine the Marx Brothers answering questions about cars. Picture Monty Python trying to imitate engine sounds. Mix that up with a little Dr. Ruth and some Smothers Brothers, and you've got car talk. You can hear Click and Clack give their advice on cars every Saturday, at 11 a.m. Hey, that's right after us, in just a half an hour. And Sunday morning at 9 a.m. right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. You're going to talk about Click and Clack?
Yeah, we should come up with cool nicknames like that for ourselves.
I think there's already a movie out, actually.
What would be computer sounds and we could take names of?
We could say bite and bit and bip and bop, something like that.
Well, there definitely is click. There's the iOmega Zip Drive clip of click of death. That's one. What?
Let me hear it.
Click.
This is what they do.
I'm not a sound effects artist.
Yeah, you got to make this clicking sound and then Sean will laugh for you. Go.
You are so in trouble.
Whatever. Anyway, this is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The clicking was from Ben Jaffe. Miles Elam is professionally silent during this ridiculousness. And Sean Cleveland. Thank you, geeks, for being here. We are taking questions on the website only, and we do have a whole bunch more news, which we're going to keep going on. And, of course, we have some other questions as well. In fact, I got a question from the forum, Miles, Sean, that I wanted to ask you. Is that okay? Come on. So, you know you want it.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. The GeekSpeak forum question was this. Is there a Vista 32-bit emulator for Vista 64-bit hardware? And I went, huh? What are you saying? So this is from Talking Mute. So I guess I should do a different thing. I guess Joe from Orlando, Florida. I have a Dazzle DVD recorder that will not work with 64-bit Vista. I didn't think it would be a problem after upgrading from 32-bit, but after talking to the folks at Pinnacle, who make the Dazzle DVD recorder, I was told that the software will work with 64-bit. Will work with 64-bit, but the hardware will not work with 64-bit. Yeah. So is there an emulator that will allow me to run hardware as 32-bit on a 64-bit machine?
The problem is a driver. There's no driver support. You can't emulate the driver.
So why would the company, Dazzle DVD Recorder or whatever, say that it's supported? I mean,
they said their software supported, but they said the hardware was not because they have not written a 64-bit driver.
So the drivers, are kind of like the very close to the operating system part that connects to hardware.
They're part of the operating system. They're part of the kernel.
They get added into the kernel?
Well, they're loaded by the kernel, yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Software can run in both 32-bit and 64-bit mode in Vista, so in the 64-bit version of Vista. That's not the problem. It's the hardware support.
Okay, so this is one of those things we're talking about that it's problematic with going to a 64-bit architecture from 32-bit.
Yep, this is exactly what we're talking about. So if you have existing devices before you move to Vista, I don't know if this is true for Vista 64. There is an update tool that tells you what devices will work and which ones don't. Yeah. Basically saying which ones have drivers and which ones don't.
Well, I don't understand something. If I have a 64-bit system and I run Vista 32-bit, I can use that hardware. And then if I switch, and the hardware's the same.
Wait, now, what do you mean 64-bit system?
If I have an operating, if I have a CPU that's 64-bit.
Yeah, most all are 64-bit. Right. I have support for 64-bit.
So that's the hardware. My hardware is 64-bit. And then I install an OS that's 32-bit, the drivers work. But if I install 64-bit, it doesn't work. So it's not exactly hardware, it's drivers.
Miles?
Right. So what's going on is even though Vista, they're both called Vista, they're like two different operating systems. Even though they have the same look and feel, they're compiled differently. It's kind of like having a driver for Windows 3.1 and then needing a driver for Windows 95. They're,
right.
One's a 16-bit environment, one's a 32-bit environment, and they're going to be substantially different in that respect. And so even though you have, even though your 386 back in the day or your 486 could run a 16-bit operating system like Windows 3.1, that doesn't mean that suddenly your hardware is 16-bit. It's still 32-bit. It just has a backward compatibility layer. Just like a 64-bit CPU these days has a 32-bit backward compatibility layer.
And this is not going to change. I've already been seeing rumors that Windows 7, which is our next version of their operating system, is still going to have separate versions for 32 and 64-bit, which is horrible. I don't see why they just get... Why can't we just get rid of 32-bit?
Because people have existing computers that they want to...
Yeah, but at some point, you got to make a call, you know, and the CPUs will have been out for 3 to 4 years with 64-bit support, even longer than that, actually.
Well, they are making a call. Microsoft, I'm looking on Ben's screen here, Microsoft has announced no more licenses for Windows 3.1. So, well, we can't get rid of 32-bit.
Yeah.
Microsoft has finally gotten rid of 16-bit.
Wait. 3.1?
Yes, Windows 3.1.
We're talking like 96.
Well, okay.
95.
No, 94.
Yeah. No, Windows 95 came out in 96.
Oh, I see.
3.1 was obsolete in 96.
Well, I mean...
But that's amazing that they just did that. Okay, let me just wait.
Years.
Let me just say one thing. One trick about this 32-bit, 32-bit, is there some kind of emulation, blah, blah. You could theoretically run Vista 32 in some kind of emulator in Windows 64, right? Run another copy of the OS and virtually.
When you're talking about drivers, though, drivers are talking about the actual hardware. When you run in a virtual environment such as VMware or something of the like, those aren't actual device, physical devices that you have drivers for. You have virtual devices that you've written drivers for.
So, but in when I run something like Parallels on a Macintosh environment and I want to use an item that works, the drivers only work for Windows, I can say this USB port is actually tied directly to Windows and pass all traffic to Windows. So couldn't...
But Parallels is not directly talking to your USB port. Parallels is talking to a driver of a virtualized USB port, which is then piped to the main
port. So this DVD recorder thing is actually a USB device, I believe. So the question is, if you did that whole porting thing with the Windows Vista in the virtual service, virtual OS, would it be able to access it? It's possible,
you
right?
You need some type of pass-through driver, I think.
Well, that's the thing is, most of the virtualization software actually has pass-through drivers for USB. So I'm curious. Like,
is it theoretically possible?
Yeah,
sure.
I think it would just make sense to grab another piece of software.
If you're
going to
do that,
piece of hardware.
You know, just run a 32-bit version of emulated OS, and then you
might as well dual boot.
Yeah,
right. That means basically you install two operating systems and you boot depending on which one you want to go with. A little complicated, but it's a solution.
It also is, why is he running a 64-bit operating system? If he's using more than 4 gigs of RAM, it makes sense.
Yeah,
if he doesn't
typically
have more than 4 gigs of RAM, there's no reason why you would need to use a 64-bit platform.
All right.
Especially if you have devices that you need 32-bit.
Yeah. Let's move on to another news story. Ben, you wanted to say
I just
one want
to briefly say about the Windows 3.1. Yeah, it was released in 1990, and it... they killed support for Windows 3.1, 3.x, until they maintained it until the end of 2001. And it's been an embedded operating system until it was officially, in all senses, killed exactly 7 days ago on the 1st.
Wow.
So, yeah. And I don't know. I mean, I can see it still being useful in some situations where it just works and, you know, there's no reason to update.
Wait a second. I remember running Windows 3.1. It did not just work.
Oh, okay. But no. I'm saying if you configure it and you get something that works, then why spend money updating it?
Sure.
Because it runs on you know, a nothing computer. I mean, it's like minimum system requirements was like it needs at least 64 kilobytes of RAM. Oh,
you know,
boy.
You know why?
Let's remember.
I mean,
let's remember Windows 3.1 was a complete failure, and Windows wasn't good until Windows 3.1.1. Remember, there was a bunch of different updates.
Okay, I suppose that's what I mean.
And then Windows for Work Groups is really the first usable version of Windows.
Gosh, remember how we had to connect games
horrible.
Together?
Apparently, it's still used power in-flight entertainment systems on some airlines.
Wow, well, don't fly on
connect
that.
Connect games together. That's what Novell was for.
Oh, remember when we were first doing network games, Sean?
Yeah.
We had to do coaxial cable and link them together. And
I remember back in the mid-80s, I was doing tech support. I was just a kid, you know, 15 years old.
Hey, my profession is tech support, pal.
I'm just waiting.
And hold on, let me finish the story. So I'm doing tech support for this tax software that online tax software company.
No way.
Yeah, 87? Way back in, it's like 85.
Okay.
You know, 80, that's 87. Okay. That's right. So it was all DOS-based,
right.
You know, and there was a guy there working next to me, and he says, you know, I've got this new piece of software, you know, that's just really amazing. It's called Windows. And we're looking at him like, what? Windows? And he fired it up as Windows 2.0, and it kind of worked, and it was just kludge, you know, it seemed like a piece of software that ran on top of DOS, you know.
Right.
And I was looking. We're all looking at it.
What does
this
do?
There's nothing this can do that you can't do with Gold Key, which at the time was a graphical user interface for your files. You know?
Right.
Everybody used it in DOS, and he didn't have a mouse, so we're using the keyboard, and that's what really drove Windows home was the mouse. You know, of course,
Sure. Forget
about Apple that was way ahead of all of this at the time. And I just remember looking, and it was a company called Microsoft, and none of us had ever heard of Microsoft, and we're like, this is dumb. And
yeah,
here we are today, you know.
Yeah,
back then, if I would have put some money down on Microsoft, I would be retired and probably still doing this show.
I'm actually waiting for all of the comments we'll get on the forum or through email of people saying, coax, you youngsters.
Sorry. All right. Yeah, I dated myself. Sorry about that. I don't know about sports and Okay, let's go on to another news story. Actually, it's not a big thing, but change.gov, what's going on, Ben?
Oh, wow.
Surprise!
Well, surprise!
On the contrary, I think it's a huge thing.
I think it's amazing.
I meant it's not a big long news story, but maybe it is. Go on.
Yeah, yeah. Without being partisan, I just have to say that the way Obama's camp ran his campaign from a technology standpoint was incredible. The way they used, you know, text messaging, the way they used the internet in all ways. Their YouTube channel has something like, I don't know, almost 2,000, I think, videos, and they just upload them constantly.
Yeah, they're very tech savvy.
They're just fast. And sure enough, the day after Obama got, became president-elect, they launched change.gov, which is this website that just kind of discusses things, you know, like the transitioning process from one administration to another, and just lays out a bunch
of
information.
Are you sure that's coming from the president-elect?
I think it is.
Roof?
I mean, they worked on it. They must have worked on it for months before.
Okay, I understand. How did they get access to a .gov root domain?
There is a transition going on between there. Like George Bush
has
met with them
Okay.
Yeah. So they're going to be making preparations before he actually takes office.
Mm-hmm.
This just being a .gov just means that
it's involved in government.
Yeah, you have federal funds supplying the name server.
Okay.
But that's about it.
And he is a senator, so he could probably request it from
right,
that perspective.
The content that's on change.gov looks very similar, I believe, to his campaign website, which had a lot of his policy positions. And so that is...
It is all overhauled a bit, though. I mean,
but they're definitely,
the same
nicer,
essence is there. It looks much... It
One
looks
of the
nicer.
Things is this transparency in government stuff, which I think his campaign's been kind of pushing for a while. Also, we covered a news story with Barack's campaign with... about having an IT and almost
a
cabinet
CTO.
Level. CTO
yeah.
level, yeah.
It's a cabinet-level position.
Cabinet-level position, which is a chief technology officer, which would be the first.
And they announced it, actually. He was saying he wants Bill Joy.
Who's Bill Joy?
One of the co-founders of Sun.
Well, that seems good.
Of Sun Microsystems.
Cool. So we'll see if that happens. All right. In any case, in this day and age, trying to not think about technology at a high level is a dangerous thing to do. And every corporation in America knows that. That's why there's a CTO. So it makes sense that the government would have somebody that was at that cabinet level position.
But it
well.
Means that there's an embracing of the technology rather than trying to push it back.
Sure. Well, look, we're not taking calls today. If you'd like to ask us questions, you're welcome to do so on the forums. You do that by geekspeak.org. We will be taking calls again next week. Sean.
Oh, do I get to do a news story?
Yeah.
Wow,
you're
this
up.
Is exciting. So Intel allowed press to talk about their new CPU this past week. So if anybody was online, well, go to the review sites. One of my favorites, Anontech, and Anon and Gary Key did quite a few stories, and they're long and very in-depth as normal. But it's a really interesting CPU. I think Conroe was a home run, so following up after a home run is kind of hard.
Which one was Conroe?
Conroe is the last CPU. So in 2006, they launched the Core 2, which, right? So that followed the Pentium 4. And when you compare those two, the Pentium 4 was not so good. And the Core 2 was just, it was a home run.
So mm-hmm. Conroe is the Core 2.
Yeah. And then in 2007, they shrunk Core 2 to 45 nanometer. And then 2008, they just launched Nehalem, which is the code name, but the CPU is called Core i7. Now, these chips won't be out until later in the month,
mm-hmm.
And I don't have the what the model numbers of these chips are going to be yet. So
it'd be nice
they really
Geek,
haven't talked
it'd be
about
nice
that.
If GeekSpeak could get a press kit with one of these or something. Check a look at it.
We're actually going to have Intel on the show.
Oh, cool.
So I'm lining that up. So the way that Intel works is they have what's called a TikTok. The way they innovate, they release chips
uh-huh.
is a TikTok.
What does that mean?
So a tick is a die shrink. So last year, they shrunk Core 2 from 65 nanometer to 45 nanometer.
Which
that's a tick.
Makes means the processor gets a lot smaller and therefore a lot less waste and faster.
Yeah,
but the same architecture.
But the same design.
The same microarchitecture. Mm-hmm. And a tock is when you actually change the microarchitecture. It's a revolutionary change.
So you're talking about structural changes, change the pipeline, change the transistors.
Yeah,
you really lay out
the
chip
itself. Yeah.
Okay.
The chip is physically a different size and has different number of transistors.
Now, okay, so when the Core 2 came out, one of the things that was really interesting about it is that it was actually a highly modified and enhanced Pentium 3. So they
sort
took
of,
Pentium
yeah,
3
yeah, yeah.
and then they went to Pentium 4, and then this was actually designed from Pentium 3, the Core 2. Is this also that same path? Or have they...
Yeah, they've pretty much taken the Core 2 and done a lot of modifications
okay.
to it.
Okay.
And I want to kind of save that for when we get Intel on the show.
Okay, we'll do that.
But it's actually smaller. This Nehalem, which is Core i7, is actually 731 million transistors, and it's down from what the Core 2 was. But the die size is a little larger. And what's, I think, the biggest change to this new architecture is that it's a quad-core design, mm-hmm. just like the Core 2 was, except the Core 2 is actually two dual-core chips on a die.
Right.
You know, and they were sharing a front-side bus. This is very different. This is four. This is a four-core design that is where each core has its own cache, and they can all talk to each other in a much better way internally than they did with the Core 2.
The terminology you're using with Core 2, and then there's Macintosh laptops, the most recent, have Core 2 Duos. That's what you're talking about.
Correct.
It's four processors, but they're in pairs.
No, a Core 2 Duo is only a two-core chip.
Oh,
a Core 2 Quad is a four-core chip.
Gotcha.
Apples don't have these new chips yet,
right.
The Core i7.
So the Core
i7. But I would
i7,
expect that's going to happen.
The Core
at some
i7
point.
Is like Core 2.
Quad,
except that each processor is really separate.
It really is a native quad-core design.
That's amazing. What's the performance like?
Well, all right. Do you want to talk any more about the architecture, or you want to just go straight for performance?
Let's just go straight for performance.
So Anontech, if you look at their results, and they got a lot of results to look at, they say that the Core i7's performance is solid.
That's important.
But I don't know. You're looking at 5 to 10% in general application performance at the same clock speeds as the Core 2. That's not bad. Where it really takes off, though, is video encoding and 3D rendering, and they're seeing about 20 to 40% jump in performance.
Whoa.
Now, what's interesting is we've heard of hyper-threading.
Yeah.
Hyper-threading is interesting technology. It allows a single core to process two threads of data. So instead of looking like a four-core chip, it looks like an eight-core chip.
Right.
Well, they've really optimized hyper-threading with this design, and it really works.
The reason why hyper-threading makes a lot of sense in a processor like this is that you actually have a whole bunch of mathematical steps, which are called stages. And when you have one process going in, lots of times if you're doing one calculation, halfway through the stage, you're ready for new stuff in the beginning, but you don't know the answer, so you can't use it. So if you run two things at the same time, like a simple example would be running Firefox and Word, and Firefox is going to do something, Word's going to do something, so they can both go through the pipeline kind of at the same time, staggered, and that's hyper-threading. That's a very loose definition.
So have they dealt with the security issues of hyper-threading that they had in the past?
What Miles there is talking about
is it's
very difficult to isolate one application from another application from a memory access point because you're not addressing it differently, but you throw things in the same pipeline. So
it's not an actual distinct CPU. It becomes
I think that's something that we would need to ask Intel when they come on.
Yeah.
Now, something else they have, this Turbo Boost technology, too, that's interesting. Not all code is optimized for multi-threading.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of code out there will only run on one core. So you got a quad-core chip, runs on one core, now?
Yeah.
Well, they can now turn off cores completely.
To save heat, to save energy.
Right, to save energy. Uh-huh. Now, they can actually take that extra energy, power, like actual power, not processing power, but electricity, and current, and over voltage or increase the performance of a single core.
So the processor itself will handle overclocking of one core if the software needs that more than multiple cores.
Yeah.
Oh, that's hot. Now, wait, doesn't the OS determine if it's going to use multiple cores, or is it the actual application?
It's the OS, I think, based on application load.
Okay, so Miles, do you agree with that, that it's like the operating system that decides if it can take an application and split it? Or some applications low enough level processor use that they would actually use the processor
operating
directly.
System absolutely has to have support for hyper-threading for that to have any good whatsoever.
Interesting.
So there's a lot to talk about with this chip.
I know.
That is really interesting, and I really want to get Intel on to do that, so we're working on that.
All right, cool. Thank you very much for that update. Miles, you got another thing.
I forgot to mention this chip is really interesting. Nobody really expected it to affect game performance.
Well, yeah, but only 5% performance on the general application, use 5 to 10, something like that. But then you did say like 40% for graphics, didn't you?
Well, 20 to 30% for 3D,
3D stuff.
Rendering but and video encoding.
But don't games normally have to use an external card, like a video card, to do that kind of stuff?
But see, what happens is your GPU can become what's called CPU bound. So the GPU is
that's a graphics processor.
Yeah, it really needs more processing power to give you more frames.
Right.
And the Nehalem, the Core i7, actually gives you that processing power. So especially if you're running multiple GPUs at high resolution. So the really hardcore gamers out there are running 24-inch screens that give you a 19x12 resolution, or 30-inch screens that give you 60x1600 resolution.
Huge resolutions.
Now, to drive those kind of resolutions in games, you need more than one card. So in multi-card, 2- and 3-card configurations, yes, the Core i7 can give you 20 to 30 frames more performance.
Wow.
It's just really incredible.
Because it's kind of doing the glue between them. The different
because those GPUs need the extra the bandwidth that the CPU provides. The memory performance. Oh, that's the other thing. Memory now, 3-channel memory is supported. So we've only had 2-channel memory support up to this point. And Core i7 systems can support 3-channel memory.
Cool. Well, thank you. I think we'll do a whole show on the new architecture from Intel.
That could go on.
So, Miles, we talk a lot about security and stuff, and you have some story about the WPA crack. What is WPA?
WPA is a wireless protection algorithm, I believe. Someone had to check. Double
protocol,
check that one.
I'll check.
WPA, oh, I see, algorithm, yeah. Okay.
And that is that's one of the best ways to secure your wireless network. And a few weeks ago, we had a story about how WPA had been cracked and WPA2 had been cracked, which would be a big deal because it means that you wouldn't be able to treat your wireless connection as secure. That you would have to go to a landline, to something like Ethernet, to protect your network communications.
And I said that because of all the unknowns in WEP and other protocols that have been cracked in the past, I'm always nervous about wireless being secure, and I don't normally trust it. But
WEP, wireless encryption protocol, was cracked years ago.
Was really, it was always been bad.
People have always talked about how you need to move to something else.
So WPA... theoretically, it says, I'm a wireless point, you're a laptop, we're going to make a connection where anybody's listening can't actually see what our data is. And therefore, it doesn't matter what kind of data we send, people can't see it.
It depends on the level of encryption that you choose.
Right, and it's been like 64-bit or 28-bit and such. Right. But it was cracked, and we talked about it being cracked.
Well,
so how bad is it?
There appears to be some contention about that, that if you use that part of what's called the TKIP, it's a key that's used to initiate the session, that part of that had been compromised, but it turns out it wasn't a complete compromise. It really didn't affect it the way people were worried that it would. And in fact, any issues that were there with TKIP can be avoided simply by disabling TKIP and using only AES encryption. Many times when you set up your wireless router, you have, for example, WPA, WPA2, and it'll say, do you want TKIP or AES or both?
What do you recommend?
What do you say?
So best case scenario
this, by
would
the way,
be...
I've seen this, by the way, in managing my thing, and I never really know what they mean. So what's
right.
the...
They're two different encryption algorithms. And so the best case scenario would be AES and turning off any support for TKIP. But from what I'm hearing from the reports, TKIP really isn't all that compromised.
Okay.
It's a one step in a long chain of steps you would need to really...
So theoretically, if you want to be more safe and you understand what the heck we're talking about, you go into your wireless settings, make sure you're not using TKIP, make sure you're using AES. That's on the or the router, if you will. And then you'll be a little safer, but most likely anybody will be safe anyway.
Right.
You'll probably be safer if you move from 64-bit to 128-bit encryption.
That's another thing, is making the key a little longer.
Which means you'll have to come up with a longer key. But think of a sentence or... Yeah.
That's one thing about passwords. We mention this every once in a while, but thinking about passwords nowadays, they can be really long, and therefore they can be a full sentence. They can be something that, you know, a friend said to you one day and you've always remembered. Use that.
Yeah. Now, important. Bear in mind, this is also saying, like, the absolute insecurity. This is, like, the deadbolt is kind of what WPA is like. And some people are saying, well, you can get past the deadbolt, so you should have an actual bar that goes from your door to the floor so that you can't open the door, you know, no matter what happens. There is always going – security is not an on or off thing.
Yeah.
It's a question of how inconvenient do you want it to be while being safe.
Right.
Safety and convenience, or security and convenience, are at opposite ends, really, of the same spectrum.
Convenience is one way to really compromise security.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you make it too difficult, people just won't use it.
GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This week on This American Life, stories of privilege and the length some will go to maintain it. A teenager with a prominent father helps cover up a crime and struggles to deal with the aftermath. And one woman's fight to stop a celebrity from breaking her city's parking laws. This week on This American Life, Sunday morning at 11 a.m. and Friday evening at 7 p.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. The geeks today, Ben Jaffe. Ben Jaffe is an independent media dude taking on commissions to do video work and probably some web work, I don't know, stuff like that. Miles Elam is a student and political junkie and tutor and trainer of people. And Sean Cleveland is a senior technical marketing manager at NVIDIA. I work up at UCSC supporting high-tech art. Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Borrego Solar, offering photovoltaic solutions that enable homes and businesses to be green and resource savvy by installing sharp solar panels. New federal tax credits with state rebates may bring solar within reach. BorregoSolar.com. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. Again, I want to remind you that Plantronics graciously gave us some headsets. We want to give them to you. We don't want to spend the cost to ship them to you, so we're inviting you to join us at the Media Camp. And you can learn more about the Public Media Camp at kosp.org. I'm Lyle Troxell for KUSP and for GeekSpeak.